Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I had a whole big introduction planned for Gloria Steinem, but Gloria is not with us. I am sorry to disappoint. We're not sure what happened, but it's a complete disconnect at this point. So we have an opportunity for an impromptu open forum. And, you know, there's always a lot of stuff to talk about. We never have enough time. So I invite you to stay tuned for an open forum and give us a call if you have something that's important to you you want to talk about, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page where I was, you know, blathering on about Gloria Steinem being on this morning, but she's not. We figure there is either a day confusion or a time confusion or something because she is a very reliable person. So what are some of the headlines that have caught your eye today? I can't help it. The OSU bumps athletic director's salary to $1 million. That headline in the Columbus Dispatch caught my eye this morning. Dispatch reporter Ken Gordon wrote about it, and it says that his services are in demand, and they because of that, made him the highest paid athletic director earlier this year. And under the terms of that contract signed in June, Gene Smith's base pay increased more than 20% to $800,000. And he is guaranteed at least $1 million a year. Contract could be worth more than $1.2 million a year if Gene Smith earns various incentive bonuses for athletic and academic performance. So what could one do to increase their pay by $200,000 a year? And what the heck is so important about an athletic director to pay him or him, at least $1 million a year? Give us a call, 614-292-8513. Oh, well, too late. Apparently, Gloria Steinem is joining us in just a second. We have her on the phone. So sorry to John and everybody else who called in. But I will mention, John, it is Local Food Week. I forgot to mention that earlier this week when I was talking about food. So everybody, it's Local Food Week. And I noticed all the icons on Facebook. You can go ahead and change your icon to reflect that it is Local Food Week. It's a very, very good week for local food. And joining us now, Gloria Steinem, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You're going to be at Ohio Wesleyan next week.
Yes.
You're going to be talking about the global activism on behalf of women. What does that mean nowadays? And it, you know, does the template change when you go global?
It does and it doesn't, you know, because local organizing is always the most important. Change happens from the bottom up. It's like building a house. But there are many ways in which we can support each other globally. We can, in this country, keep from exporting sexism by some of our practices and where foreign aid goes, where expertise goes. And we can be a rescue operation for each other, in a sense, because, as with Amnesty International and other organizations, we can alert the rest of the world, or much of the world, to very big dangers to women's human rights on the ground that those particular women may not be able to do. And sometimes, frequently, the issues are the same. Say, the whole business of sex trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly knows no boundaries. So it's very helpful for women's groups, whether they're in India or wherever, you know, in an African country, here, to meet together, see how similar the problems are, share expertise about the current most effective ways to both support the survivors and get effective law enforcement. That's very helpful.
My guest is Gloria Steinem. She's going to be at Ohio Wesleyan University next week. We got her today. If you'd like to give us a call and join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org and go back to that All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and say, oh, no, Gloria is here. I'm wondering about, well, in Iran, where the woman is facing possible stoning to death for, I'm not really sure what her crime has been, apparently adultery, but that isn't what she might be stoned for, or she was going to be stoned for. But things like that and those kind of stories, that used to be not that unusual, and now at least we're hearing about it. How important is it to women's rights around the world that we even hear about this stuff that used to be sort of commonplace and was under the radar before?
Well, obviously it's big time crucial, because we can't intervene and support each other unless we have knowledge of what's going on. So really, for the past 30 years or so, ever since Sisterhood is Global, which is really the first big network of this kind, we've been trying to have our own network so we can inform each other and then bring pressure to bear. Frequently, it's only the strong light of international press and disapproval that makes a difference for those women on the ground. So, you know, it is, I don't want to be overly cheerful and say, I mean, we still probably only know about symbolic cases.
Right.
But nonetheless, to the extent that that creates an idea of what normal is and denormalizes those kinds of abuses, it's very important.
The Paycheck Fairness Act, that long-stalled bill that would go to end wage disparities, I don't know how long it's been around, but it has been pitched by some as a weapon to force women against men and empower trial lawyers and all sorts of dastardly deeds. One critic said, though, that the better things get for women, the angrier the women's studies professors seem to be, and the more depressed Gloria Steinem seems to get. And I wondered, Gloria, are you depressed?
No, I'm definitely not depressed. who was saying that?
You know, I don't have it right, the source right in front of you. I'm glad to give it to you later. It was just cited in, I think, a New York Times story. And I'm wondering, though, about that kind of thing. And as long as you've been in the movement, been at the forefront, in the vanguard in our day and age, do you get depressed about how far we've come?
You know, what depression is, psychologists tell us, mm-hmm. is anger turned inward.
Hmm.
So if we are healthily angry at injustice, we can use our anger as a kind of energy cell to make positive change. Depression comes from a feeling that nothing is ever going to change, and I do not have that feeling.
What about the Paycheck Fairness Act? What is the idea that someone would say that it would pit women against men?
You know, I have no idea, because actually the concept of fairness applies to everybody. And this really is fixing problems with the law that we could see in cases where there was a time limit. If women had been unable to know that their pay was unequal until a certain date, and that date was passed kind of moratorium in the legislation, then they couldn't do anything about it. And this was further exaggerated by the fact that it was sometimes grounds for firing to share the knowledge of your salaries. So, for instance, in New York State, we had to have a Pay Free Speech Act so that you could not get fired for simply sharing the knowledge of how much you were being paid.
In 1970, in testimony before Congress on gender equity, you said that women's liberation is men's liberation, too. And I'm wondering what you think about how men are doing in this regard.
You know, there's a lot of change in wherever you look. It's true, for instance, that there are many, many more men who are doing much more of their own caretaking and raising children, raising their own kids, than their fathers were. It's just that though the trend line is up, it's still clear that women are doing the huge share. That means that they probably statistically have two jobs, you know, one outside the home and one inside the home. But men benefit in all kinds of important ways. For instance, one can really say that the masculine role is killing men. If you look at the statistics on why men die and take out those that could reasonably be attributed to the masculine role, death from guns, from violence, from speeding, from tension-related diseases. Men live at least 4 years longer. So I always say to audiences of men, you know, what other movement has 4 more years of life to offer you? This is pretty good.
We have a Facebook comment from Sean and a question. He says, look, he's looking forward to the interview. Mm-hmm. But the quote, a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, is commonly attributed to Gloria. I think she also said, quote, most American children suffer too much mother and too little father. Today, mm-hmm. nearly 75% of African American and 50% of white children are born into fatherless homes in Columbus. How does she view the nature of the relationship between men and women now? Do men need women? Do women need men? Those are all in quotation marks. Do children, quote unquote, need the influence of both?
Well, on the first quote, the fish and bicycle quote, mm-hmm. I have to say that I did not say it. I think it's quite funny, and I wish I had said it. But I'm going to walk into another room here where I am and see if I can get you the name. I think I have on my bulletin board of the wonderful Australian member of parliament who did say it. As a student, she was reading a philosopher who said that man without God is like a fish without a bicycle, and she just transposed it, and it sort of went around the world. Well, I don't see it right now. But anyway, it wasn't me.
Okay. Well, we'll look that up.
Okay.
Try to get that. But the concept of it?
Well, first of all, I wish we just didn't label masses of human beings as by race, by sex, by... You know, some women and some men are quite content not being married and not having children, and others are very focused on it. But, you know, you don't have a relationship with men as a group. You have a relationship with Irving or James. We can't make those kind of group judgments. I do think that the relationships usually are more honest now. Because in the past, love often was really dependency, economic dependency, when you looked at it more closely, that women didn't have the choice of living on their own. And so they often, if we think about our parents and our grandparents, tolerated situations they would not have tolerated if they had an economic choice. So in that sense, it has to be better.
We're going to have to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be with Gloria Steinem again. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, the battle between muckraking columnist Jack Anderson and Richard Nixon. Writer Mark Feldstein says Anderson cut ethical corners to get Nixon exposés, and Nixon responded with fury.
The Nixon CIA sent a team of 16 covert agents that surveilled Anderson and his family and his staff around the clock.
Feldstein's new book is Poisoning the Press. Join us.
And Fresh Air begins at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. 60 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:19 this morning. Sunshine today, a high of 73. A few clouds tonight, and a low of 48. Connect with WOSU through one of our e-newsletters. Visit wosu.org/email and sign up to receive emails about our news programming, special events, classical music, and more. Connect with WOSU Public Media at wosu.org/email. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gloria Steinem, the pioneering feminist, journalist, best-selling author, and activist. She's going to be at Ohio Wesleyan University next week. Gloria, what's your take on the Obama administration at this midterm point of the election cycle?
You know, that is a huge question, of
yes,
course.
Yes, it is.
I guess I could sum it up by saying there are many things that I wish had been done differently. You know, I wish we had at least fought for the public option in our health care battle. You know, it seemed to me that though it's admirable to want to reach out and create consensus, he failed to recognize that that was impossible in the particular situation of the ultra-right-wing control of the Republican Party. And also he inherited some Democrats who were not actually Democrats, who probably were the results of tactics of Rahm Emanuel, who seemed not to care about issues, but, you know, when he was head of the DSCC, but simply people who labeled themselves Democrats. So it isn't that I don't have regrets and disagreements, but I'm really not sure that anyone else could have done better. And he is a good person. His head and his heart are connected. And mostly I think that when we look upward in that way and say, you know, how is he doing, or who can he win or she win, we've given up our power, because our real question is, what are we going to do? That's the one thing that we can control. Incidentally, you know, before we were talking about relationships between women and men, mm-hmm. and trying to generalize, and I was saying poorly that generalization is not so great, but it reminded me, since we're talking about quotes, mm-hmm. of a wonderful quote from Robin Morgan: hate generalizes, love specifies.
Details are a wonderful thing. By the way, we have the source of the quote, whatever it is.
The woman fish and the bicycle?
Yeah, the fish and the bicycle quote is Irina Dunn.
Thank you so much. I so appreciate you being able to find it when I can't. Thank you.
Thanks to Jeff the intern for that, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.
Out there, everybody was looking. 614-292-8513. And Jim, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. My question for your guest is, why does the women's movement in America tend to remain invisible and off the radar when it comes to the issue of Muslim women and how they are treated? You know, they just seem to be completely out of the picture that way.
You know, if so, it's because it's not getting covered in the press, because that is a very big issue in the women's movement, both as it has to do with immigrants and undocumented immigrants, and with bias in general. For instance, the women's movement groups here in New York have been very forceful in saying, of course, people can build a mosque and a social center, you know, in downtown Manhattan. We're either religiously tolerant or we're not. And also in protesting policies in other countries, in France, for instance, where they are trying to penalize women for wearing headscarves in public school, or girls in public schools, because, you know, we're for choice, you know, that we're for the power to make those decisions ourselves. And more Muslim women are organizing as part of the women's movement. There's the Muslim Women's Fund, for instance, and, you know, many other such organizations. I think as long as 20 years ago, there was a big conference in Washington on one of the university campuses that produced a great document showing the support for women's rights within the Quran, so that Muhammad in his day was a reformer. And, you know, one can use most religious texts to argue both ways. Certainly people use the Bible that way, but that there were many supports for expanded rights for women within the Quran.
Thank you, Jim.
Okay.
Take care. 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org to speak with Gloria Steinem. We have an email from George. Do you make any distinction between the condition of elite women and average women? The condition of average women seems to have deteriorated by most measures. The percentage of women living in poverty, in prison, victims of crime, drug addicts, etc., have all increased. Elite women seem willing to send poor women to war as long as they do not have to do it themselves.
No, I don't agree with any of that, needless to say. I agree with him on only one thing, which is that there are more women in prison, which has to do with drug laws and with the nature of the criminal justice system. But if you look at articles in Ms. Magazine over the years, you will see protests of that. big time, and the whole question of equal pay is something that affects poor women much more than elite women, so to speak, and the double role of being both a responsible for kids and also working outside the home is something that always has affected poor women and now affects the majority of women. So, you know, I don't know what experience he's had, but and I'm sure everything is true sometime, but I do not think that's generally true.
You know, speaking of disagreeing with George, our last emailer, back in 1972, you disagreed with an assertion on Meet the Press, and we want to listen to that clip. Let's listen to Gloria Steinem in a Meet the Press interview from September of 1972. In this clip, the moderator, Lawrence Spivacs, is asking Gloria Steinem, the activist, to explain herself.
Ms. Steinem, may I ask you a question? You made a speech before the National Press Club this year, and you said, and I quote, "Women are not taken seriously. We are undervalued, ridiculed, or ignored by a society which consciously and unconsciously assumes that the white male is the standard and the norm." Now, what's your explanation for this serious state of affairs in view of the fact that men, males, are at least virtually controlled and dominated by women from birth to puberty and often beyond that? Why haven't you done a better job if you're as smart as you say you are?
Well, it's your statement, not mine, that men are virtually controlled by women from birth onward. I mean, if you take a very an intelligent person with the normal hopes and ambitions and confine her to the home, she becomes sometimes over-dominating within those four walls, as a man would be as well. But the truth of her situation is that she has no real power over her life outside the home, nor does she have power over the economics or the politics of her life.
Gloria Steinem, do you remember that interview?
You know, I didn't until I saw it replayed somewhere, and I thought, you know, the nature of the question, somehow big time blaming the victim, or if not the victim, the subject, rather, it was kind of breathtaking, wasn't it? And I think, wasn't he the one who invented that show?
Yeah, I think he was, I think, the first main moderator for the show.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I, you know, folks who work here and heard that to prepare for the show, were younger people were just astounded that anyone could even say something like that. And I suppose when you do the, you know, you talk about how far have we come, when you look at it in terms of something like that, quite a ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's good to look back because change is so gradual that it's like the oxygen in the air, and sometimes we fail to appreciate how far we've come.
614-292-8513. I guess he goes on to say that, why don't women brainwash men when raising them as boys? What do you think?
Well, children, and indeed all of us, but especially children, do what they see, not what they're told. So the example they have before them, especially then and sometimes still, is a woman who is less powerful than a man, a father who is more considered, earns more, has more freedom outside the house, you know, all of the above, than the woman. So children see that. And it's part of the reason that the model of patriarchy, you might say, is for men to accept their fathers and women to reject their mothers and also accept their fathers. So both genders are supposed to accept the superiority of somebody who's born male.
614-292-8513. You'd like to give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have an email now from Carolyn. She writes, "Gloria, being progressive and a feminist, what's your take on Sarah Palin's political rise?"
You know, there was Phyllis Schlafly before there mm-hmm. was Sarah Palin. There's Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court. And I think this is all, in large part, a phenomenon. In a way, it's a tribute to the civil rights movement and to the women's movement, because it means that the opposition has to identify and use people who look like us but behave like them. Now, I support Sarah Palin's equal rights, and I do not want to see people saying she can't run for office because she has young children, as some people were saying in the case of the vice presidency. I want to see her treated fairly, but she does not represent the majority of women on issues, and her constituency is far more male than female. I guess that McCain was unwise enough to think that Hillary supporters would somehow be more likely to vote for the ticket because there was a woman on it, without understanding that women were more than smart enough to figure out what this woman stood for. The idea is not to get a job for one woman, it's to make life more fair for women and therefore for all of us. So I was quite proud of the fact that I at least could not find one single Hillary supporter who supported the McCain ticket because of Sarah Palin.
You know, we were talking about Rahm Emanuel a few minutes ago when we were talking about the Obama administration. Of course, he's the chief of staff for the Obama administration. And you have said that not only would you campaign against him if he runs for mayor of Chicago, but that you were shocked there weren't any women running for the job. And women still aren't running for office at a rate that is even close to their numbers in American society. What do you think about that?
Well, actually, that was a bit of either a misquote or misunderstanding, because what I was saying was that I was shocked that the New York Times, in its two articles about the mayoralty race, hadn't recorded the three women who are running.
So,
there may well be a female candidate, even though it's clear that Rahm Emanuel is far ahead at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the rate of women running for elective office, though? It's still very low. There's the White House Project. There are other things like Emily's List and Women's Political Caucus and all kinds of groups out there, but the numbers don't change very much.
Well, the numbers of women running do change. The numbers of women elected occasionally change, you know, as in the Year of the Woman in 92 and others. It is difficult, however, because women are less likely to get up in the morning, look in the mirror, and say, I see a political candidate. So it takes usually groups like the White House Project to identify and support and train women who would be excellent political candidates. We should do that ourselves, actually. If listeners today know a female human being of any race or group who would be great for a particular office, whether it's on the school board or running for Congress, tell her that, because we need to break the spell of the idea that women can't or shouldn't run.
That's on a very personal level, and you talk about that a lot. It's the personal, and you mentioned that. Don't generalize. Talk about James or Philip or whatever instead of generalizing about men. And I wonder, do organizations like the White House Project, Emily's List obviously is about money, but it doesn't necessarily support all women candidates either. But do those organizations matter over time, or do they just fade into the mainstream and it's that personal acknowledgement?
Well, it's both things, and we have the most responsibility where we have the most power, so we can each be helpful. But Emily's List is actually the biggest political action committee in the country, and it got started because Harriet Woods lost very narrowly for the Senate from Missouri. And if you track the results of that going forward, you can see what a huge difference it would have made, and Clarence Thomas wouldn't have been on the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court wouldn't have stopped the recount of votes in Florida for which the Florida Supreme Court had voted, and Bush wouldn't have been president. I mean, it's like for want of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. You begin to see how terribly important it really is. It was because of that narrow, tragic loss that only had to do with a lack of money in the last week, because otherwise she was ahead, that Emily's List got started. So, it really has made a profound difference. And they support pro-choice Democratic women. There is a committee also that supports pro-choice Republican women, mm-hmm. but the Republican Party has been so much in the control of extremists who are very out of step with the Republican traditions of Eisenhower, Rockefeller, and other centrists, that the it's been very difficult for representative Republicans to get through the primary process.
Emily's List did not support a U.S. Senate candidate in the primary. Jennifer Bruner, the Secretary of State in Ohio, against Lee Fisher. He's now the candidate. She had much less money, but she only came within a couple percentage points of winning that nomination. And now Lee's Fisher's way behind in the general race. There was never very clear why Emily's List didn't support her. She's a Democratic pro-choice candidate, but.
You know, I can't answer that.
I know you can't, but
yeah, and I think they should have supported her too, and I don't know why. I mean, some of the like the Planned Parenthood Action Fund and other groups may choose not to support one half of a contest when both are pro-choice.
Mm-hmm.
But since Emily's List is focused on female candidates, it wouldn't make sense.
614-292-8513. And Diane, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's such an honor to speak with you, Ms. Steinem. And I wanted to say I appreciate you saying earlier about it's all about choice. I'm someone who considers myself third wave. I have an advanced degree, but I'm at home and I don't work for pay. I volunteer and I do all kinds of things, although I do help my husband in his business. But my question to you is there's been a lot of talk about this recession and how many men have lost their jobs and calling it a man session, and how, you know, at present, and the trends are continuing, that there are more mothers, especially of young children, in the workforce than there are fathers, and more women are educated and more educated than men, and our gains in employment, especially over the last, I would say, you know, 10, 15 years, and I wanted kind of just your take on how you see that, and if you see that too as a positive thing, and if you believe that will continue, that there will continue to be those kinds of gains, at least in the employment and the educational sector, for women.
Well, you know, I do not consider it a gain for women that men have lost their jobs more than women have. It's because they are in the higher paying areas of manufacturing, construction, and unionized jobs. It's because those areas have been hit more, men have lost their jobs. Women are more in pink collar. They're 70% in pink collar underpaid jobs. So they are still working, but for less money, and are more likely to be the sole support of a whole family. So, this is not a competition of tiers here. We're trying to make...
Absolutely not.
Yeah. We're trying to make clear that women should also be eligible for the unionized manufacturing, higher-paid jobs, because as you point out about education, it's true that on many campuses there are more female undergraduates than male, but part of the reason that is true is because women are trying desperately to escape the pink-collar ghetto to get... But what it gets them is a white-collar ghetto in which female college graduate is paid less than a male high school graduate, because the male high school graduate is more likely to be in a better paid physical labor or construction or unionized job. So, you know, part of the reason women go to college is not that they come out doing better or as well as male college graduates. They're still only doing as well as male high school graduates.
Thanks, Diane.
Thank you.
We have to take another break. My guest is Gloria Steinem. You can join the conversation if you call 614-292-8513. In 1972, Gloria Steinem co-founded Ms. Magazine. She served as editor there for 15 years and continues to be a consulting editor. She also helped found Choice USA, the Ms. Foundation for Women, and the National Women's Political Caucus, among other organizations. She's the author of many books. We'll be right back with Gloria Steinem in just a minute. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, politicians say they can cut taxes and the deficit. Ronald Reagan's budget director, David Stockman, now says that's a big lie. We'll hear him out. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
And On Point begins at 1 o'clock this afternoon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. In public radio, listener feedback is very important. We want to hear your thoughts on our radio programming, including All Sides with Ann Fisher. So NPR has partnered with WOSU and we're creating an online audience advisory panel. We want you to be a part of it. Go to WOSU.org/survey. There you can sign up and send us your thoughts. It only takes a couple of minutes. WOSU.org/survey. And it's 61 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:41 this morning. Sunshine today, a nice fall day in central Ohio, a high of 73. A few clouds tonight, a low of 48 degrees, sunshine for Friday, and a high of 65. And looking ahead to the weekend, sunshine for Saturday and Sunday, but a little chilly with highs in the upper 50s. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820, NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Gloria Steinem. Gloria, you co-founded the Women's Media Center in 2004, and I guess you were in Chicago last week to promote that. Why is something like that important? I was talking to someone yesterday who said, well, women are on every television show now. They're everywhere. What do you need a media center for?
When you look at who determines what gets covered, which are called the clout positions in media, it's only 3% women. So it is very necessary that we point that out and also that we have a way of talking about bias in the media. This is a kind of second or third generation organization because it's true there are now enough women in the media so that we can form a critical mass. But by getting together in the Women's Media Center, that's the critical mass. We're still nowhere near a critical mass in terms of determining what gets covered.
614-292-8513. Barbara, you're on the air. You're the Fairfield County Auditor.
I am, till tonight at 11:59. Today is my last day of work, but I've certainly enjoyed your show today, Ann, and I like your show anyway. I don't always get to hear it. Maybe I will now.
Why is it your last day?
I'm retiring.
Oh, you're retiring. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm 69, so I've always admired Ms. Steinem, and even if when I haven't agreed with her, I certainly was always for women's rights before my time. That's why I'm such an outlaw here. But I wanted to comment on why I think more women don't run for office. I think partly it's because it's such a dirty business, as you know, Anne, working at the newspaper. And the other thing is it's about money. And women don't have control of the money.
Mm. Now, I certainly agree. First of all, I admire you and I thank you for being an auditor, which is a field in which you probably were a pioneer. So I thank you very much for that. On the question of politics being a dirty business, I'm old enough, and you are too, although we may have been in different places, to remember when the Nixon administration decided to campaign on the idea that politics are dirty, your vote doesn't count, because they benefited from a low voter turnout. I don't think politics are any dirtier than any other business, and probably less so, because it does have to do with public service. People who really want to get rich don't go into politics,
Pardon? I'm not sure I agree with that. I don't know anybody who's retired from Congress who's poor.
Because they may have been well-to-do before they got in, but they didn't, for the most part, from McGovern to, they didn't get rich on those salaries. And
that would be true.
I'm not convinced it's fair to demonize politics because it does serve to keep us out of it. But I do agree with you on the money question because, for instance, just in my own experience campaigning or raising money for candidates, the same people will give me, say, $250 for a female Senate candidate and $1,000 for the male Senate candidate, even though they're the same on the issues, just because there's a kind of unconscious notion that women could get along on less or they're ashamed to give men less. And, you know, that's at a very psychological level. At an economic level, clearly, the folks who have accumulated wealth, I mean, we talk about the feminization of poverty, but we also have to talk about the masculinization of wealth. And that's part of the reason, you're quite right, a big part of the reason, that there are fewer women candidates. When there are women, they often win because of house-to-house grassroots organizations, not because of money paying for media and so on.
That would be in my experience. And in Ohio, even though women's Republican clubs give to the Ohio Federation of Republican Women, the money that they raise goes to congressional candidates or federal offices. It does go to local offices like mine, which is where women need to start. You can't always start at the U.S. Senate, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree. And I think that in both the Democratic and the Republican parties, women need to rebel and stop being the female auxiliary and put the money to races like yours, you know, or races where they think it should go and not...
I mean, I walked door to door and, you know, made my own tuna fish sandwiches.
Yes,
so.
good for you.
You know, that's kind of interesting when you brought up the way Nixon campaigned as if politics was a dirty business. My mom ran for a county commission seat back in Kent County, Michigan, and... when I interviewed her about that a few years ago for a column, actually about the White House project, she told me that one of the comments she got from a lot of women was, "Why do you want to get involved in that? It's such a dirty business." And now that kind of it's an interesting context for me to understand that.
Some of my experience is that it can be dirty, and one of the things that I have another issue with, and this is going to really get me in trouble, but if you want to run for a state office in Ohio, there's a caucus there in either party, and you're expected to raise a specific amount of money that goes to the caucus before you're put on any committees or have any power.
Mm-hmm. Well, that sounds like a good subject of an article to be done.
Well, Barbara,
I could go on.
Well, Barbara, thanks for your call.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Have a great retirement. 614-292-8513. You know, it was pointed out to me a second ago that Meg Whitman, running for California governor, has spent $119 million of her own money. That's not that unusual. If you do have money, you're probably going to have to spend it if you're a female candidate.
But I don't think anybody should, male or female, should be able to buy a race in that way, you know, so I don't feel...
Not comforted by that.
No, I'm not comforted by Meg Whitman or Carly Fiorentino, you know.
Fiorentino.
Yeah, it's just wrong. I mean, one of the basic changes that should be made is that all media... especially the airwaves that on radio and television that belong to the public, should be free for candidates. Most money that's raised goes into media, and this makes no sense. You know, that media belongs to us. It should be free to the candidates, and that single change would take out the necessity for huge sums of money.
What about publicly funding campaigns?
Yes, publicly funding, which we've done somewhat by the, you know, being able to say we want money to go to campaigns in our checkoff when we pay our taxes. But that really doesn't address the biggest need for money, which is the media.
614-292-8513. If you'd like to speak with Gloria Steinem. Lucy, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I have a question about discrimination against women, specifically over age 55. I see that in my profession, and I had read an article from an attorney that suggested that women over 55 should be a protected class. Would you comment on that, please?
Well, there is, I mean, women and men are protected against age discrimination, so women certainly should be able to use that legislation.
Right, but it seems like specifically with, you know, the push for us to all to work longer, I do see an advantage that men have over 55 compared to women.
Well, unless I'm missing something, which I may be, I think the legislation should apply equally to women, so women should be able to use it.
It does, but I think proving age discrimination is really, really difficult because they'll say, well, we're hiring men over 55, not necessarily, but you know, they're not really hiring very many women over 55.
Mm-hmm. Well, it has to be, I believe, you know, the same requirements for a specific job. If they hire a man over 55 and refuse an equally qualified woman, then I would urge you to bring a legal action about that.
Thanks, Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
Take care. Gloria, you're working on a new book.
Yes, I've been working on a new book for quite a long time, and I'm hoping eventually to get it. Ironically, it's a book about being on the road, and I'm on the road all the time, so
right.
I don't have time to finish.
It's called Road to the Heart?
Well, that's its current title.
Okay.
It may end up with a different title.
I love the subtitle that you're working on, though. It's as America as if everyone mattered.
Oh, you like that.
I do.
That's one of the candidates to be the whole title. So
okay.
I'll put them all on the sheet of paper and ask your advice.
Okay. But America as if everyone mattered. Why that?
Because it's the attitude of social justice movements, and it's what I observe as I travel, and it is not usually the attitude of the media that we read or the histories that we read, and of course the as if is ironic. I thought it was a way of pointing that out.
Right. Okay, 614-292-8513. Dale, you're on the air. You want to talk about abortion.
Good morning, Ann. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, I'd like to wade into this subject, and let me preface this by saying that I started as a longtime admirer of Ms. Steinem and a longtime supporter, a vociferous supporter of a woman's right to choose. But here's my question. At base, there has always been a tension between the right of a woman to control her own body and the right of a fetus, or that is to say, an unborn fetus, to life. The Supreme Court decision, Roe versus Wade, being established back in 1972, some 38 years ago, there have been and will continue to be advances in medical technology that shorten the time, or lengthen the time, I suppose, of viability, so that at some point, if a fetus is viable outside the womb, some people would argue that at that point the balance of power shifts to the fetus's right to life. I guess my question for Ms. Steinem is, does she ever see a point at which the terms of the debate over Roe versus Wade will change as a result of these advances in medical technology?
The terms of the Supreme Court decision were not the terms that the women's movement in general was supporting. The idea was not, I mean, because they got into lengths of, you know, and ideas of viability and so on, that was never what NARAL and the many state and other organizations wanted. The point was just who makes the decision, if you see what I mean, a woman and her physician or the government. In most other cases of whether a life is viable or not, the medical establishment combined with the patient make that decision. Why is this uniquely a subject of government surveillance? It's like nationalizing women's bodies. So, you know, the point to me is not what is less what the decision is than who makes the decision.
And so you don't ever see a point at which I guess what I'm
No, but you. But look, I mean, you still, you know, you would still have to forcibly, if a woman doesn't want to bear a child, do you want to forcibly tie her down, invade her body, and take the fetus out? I don't think so.
So
the question, the practical question, is who makes the decision?
Thank you.
Thanks, Dale, for your call. You know, Gloria, some people still flinch when they hear the word feminist. Lots of people are openly hostile to the concept. It's not unusual at all. And many young women, and this goes back when I was in college 25 years ago, many young women will tell you that they don't need the women's movement to get ahead. Thank you very much. They can do it themselves. What's your response to that now in 2010?
Well, and I'm glad that young women think they can do it themselves, but when they
good point
when they get out in the world and discover the inequity, then they may feel differently. It's why women get more activist with age in general. I don't mean everyone, but you know, we tend to be more conservative when we're young and more activist when we're older, and men tend to be the other way around, more activist and rebellious when they're young and get more conservative as they get older, because women lose power with age, men gain power with age. You just have to experience the world out there before you know what's necessary. So I think that makes perfect sense. As for the word feminist, first of all, there are other wonderful words that mean the same thing. Womanist is a great word. Mujerista is a wonderful word. I wish I spoke Spanish so I could say that. It sounds right. I could call myself that. Women's liberationist, you know, there are all kinds of words. But the point is that feminist actually is a word that more women identify with than identify as Republicans. Or as Democrats or as evangelicals, despite the long campaign to demonize the word. Rush Limbaugh has been calling me a feminazi for I don't know how long. You know, so the word, I think it's quite impressive that despite the effort to demonize the word and pretend that it means man-hating or I don't know what, still at least a third of women self-identify as feminist without any definition, and given the dictionary definition, it's more than 60%. So that's quite amazing.
You know, I saw a posting on some random blog. I can't give you the source, although I'll look for it if you want it. I was reading it yesterday, and it said this about you. I don't primarily define Steinem as a great feminist thinker. Rather, she is a great social philosopher across many non-gender, non-race, non-religion, non-nationality, and non-era-dependent disciplines.
Well, I'm very honored by that description. I'll do my best to live up to it. But I would say that that's what feminism is. I mean, feminism in saying males and females are human beings on an equal footing is taking away the first way we are divided into the leaders and the led, into those who cook and those who eat, into, you know, all kinds of divisions. And it's that first division that often prepares us to believe that racial divisions are okay, the class divisions are okay, because it sort of prepares the ground for birth-based difference. So I would say that all feminists, I mean, if you think of a feminist in the terms of that nice blogger, I would say that what the blogger says has to do, describes not just me, but all feminists.
That's all the time we have. Gloria Steinem, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it very much. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820, NPR News.